It's Monday, November 29th, and of course this variant would start with the words, oh my. We start here. Right as Americans get a taste of normalcy, a new strain of COVID rattles confidence.
Is it more transmissible? Does it cause more severe disease?
There's a lot we don't know about Omicron. We'll tell you what we do. Congress returns to Washington with a deadline looming.
The government runs out of funding on Friday.
Could this all end with a government shutdown? And it's not the trial of Jeffrey Epstein, but to his victims, it's the next closest thing.
They're going to say that she played a key role in a sex trafficking conspiracy.
Epstein's alleged accomplice is about to face a jury. From ABC News, this is Start Here. I'm Brad Milkey. COVID-19 has destroyed so many lives already by itself, but a particular version of it, the Delta variant, has really dictated a lot of our last year.
The growing concern about the Delta variant,
that highly contagious Delta variant,
driving up cases, particularly among the unvaccinated.
Delta was so much more infectious than the original that it affected how officials talked about travel patterns. It reshaped when vaccinated people were supposed to wear masks.
Even though you have vaccinated teachers and vaccinated personnel, you want to give that extra added level of protection for the children.
But half a year later, many Americans had gotten their boosters, they'd swabbed their noses, they finally felt okay enough to have a big Thanksgiving dinner. It felt like this big national exhale.
Omicron B11529 is named as a variant of concern because it has some concerning properties.
Well, on Friday morning, Black Friday of all days, the World Health Organization came out and announced it had identified another variant. This version of the virus had its own genetic sequence and its own letter of the Greek alphabet.
Americans waking up to the concerning news about Omicron.
The so-called Omicron variant, first identified in South Africa.
There have been more than a dozen variants of concern. Alpha, Beta, Epsilon, Theta. But could anything screw up our recovery as much as Delta? Well, as stock markets opened, we seem to get Wall Street's answer.
Wall Street taking a hit on the news, the Dow plunging more than 900 points.
By midday Friday, European countries had announced travel restrictions to southern Africa.
The early indications we have of this variant is that it may be more transmissible than the Delta variant.
By Friday afternoon, President Biden had followed suit. By Friday night, vaccine makers said they'd started working on updated vaccine recipes to address Omicron in case it became necessary.
The country already seeing troubling signs of a winter surge, hospitalizations rising for a third straight week.
But the question most Americans had as they packed up leftovers and hugged their family members goodbye and traveled to their homes was, how dangerous is this thing? And what happens if I'm carrying it? So let's start you off this week with an Omicron explainer. We got ABC's chief medical correspondent, Dr. Jennifer Ashton's with us. Dr. Ashton, what should we know here? Like, what makes this new COVID variant different from the others?
Well, Brad, first of all, I think let's start with the pronunciation of it. There's already
a
debate. Is it Omicron or Omicron? You say tomato, I say tomato. I think it really doesn't matter. We're all talking about the same variant here. And the answer to your question of what we know, what we don't know more than we know at this point. There is much more unknown about this new variant. And right now, it is just too early. We know that this is now designated by the World Health Organization as a variant of concern.
This variant has a large number of mutations, and some of these mutations have some worrying characteristics.
In terms of, and here come the big questions, is it more transmissible? Does it cause more severe disease? Does it evade our immune system, either the immunity we have via natural infection or vaccines or both? Does it evade diagnostics or testing? And are our therapeutics, our drugs, our treatments for Delta or COVID-19, will they work the same way against this?
There's a lot of work that is ongoing in South Africa and in other countries to better characterize the variant itself in terms of transmissibility, in terms of severity.
All of those unknown at this time.
So unknown. I was going to say, because the doctor who basically found the thing and sequenced it in South Africa said, this seems like it's more transmissible. It also seems like they're pretty mild infections among the patients we've been seeing in Southern Africa so far. We've seen it in several other countries since then. But you're saying we don't know whether it's actually better or worse or somewhere in between.
it is absolutely appropriate for doctors in different parts of the world to share their experience with this variant. But that doesn't mean that it will behave the same way in different populations. And really, one clinical experience does not make a complete clinical fingerprint, if you will, for this variant. So that's great and important information that this doctor from South Africa mentioned that. But we need to know how it behaves in tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands, millions of people before we can make sweeping generalizations or characteristics.
How far has it gone, though? Do we know? Like, are we getting a sense by these, you know, a dozen cases at a time in this European country or this African country? Do we know how far it's spread and whether it's in the U.S. already?
Well, here's what's important when you hear about travel bans or travel restrictions. First of all, the data is not conclusive whether those restrictions help, how important they are, what kind of impact they can have.
Travel bans when you have a highly transmissible virus never completely would get the virus to coming, prevent it from coming into the country. No way that's going to happen. But what you can do is you can delay it enough to get us better prepared. And that's the thing that people need to understand.
But by the time it's detected in one part of the world, there is no reason to think that for some reason we have a Teflon shield around the United States and it's not here yet. And people should not be alarmed or surprised when they hear that this variant is already in the United States.
Countries such as Canada, the US, the UK, Israel, Japan, and many more are now restricting or halting travel to South Africa.
And the other thing, Brad, when you talk about these travel restrictions, is over the weekend we heard bans for people coming from South Africa into various countries. And, you know, there's really controversy of whether or not that's punitive, whether that is the right thing to do, because really all the scientists in South Africa did is describe what was going on. They didn't start this variant, right?
If we leave particularly Africa or other parts of the world behind with vaccination, and we allow the virus to continue circulating quite easily in populations, then we will continue to see the emergence of these variants.
Putting these travel restrictions in place almost acts like punishment, or can seem like punishment, for these countries that are trying to be transparent and share scientifically and medically relevant and important information.
So we want to prepare as best as we can, but it may turn out that this preparation, although important, may not necessarily push us to the next level. People talking about lockdowns, people talking about that.
So that's all helpful. What do we do with all that information, though, Dr. Jen? Like, so, you know, we saw Wall Street freak out. We see doctors say, you know, we still don't know a whole lot. Well, what do we do in the meantime?
Well, I think what's important is, let's go back to a line you've heard me say before in this pandemic, Brad, which is viruses mutate for a living. So when we hear a headline like there's a new variant, that's like saying there's a new baby born. That
not
will continue to happen. The best we can do as individuals is get vaccinated, do what we can do, take the steps that we can take right now, which include vaccination and, in certain situations, masking, vigilance, if you have access to it, surveillance, screening tests. Be prepared to isolate and have a plan in place. But all you can do is, as we say in medicine, hope for the best and plan for the worst.
And a lot of doctors say, if you should know one thing today, it's that your vaccine is not some offer-on switch. There's not going to suddenly be some variant that just isn't affected at all by the vaccine. Certain variants may chip away at the efficacy, but overall, the vaccine is still the most important weapon in our arsenal against COVID-19 in all of its forms. Dr. Jennifer Ashton, great stuff. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Brad.
Next up on Start Here, this time Friday, the government will be out of spending money. The last-minute negotiations are underway after the break. With daylight saving time upon us, we're looking forward to more daylight and longer days from March through November, and while setting our clocks forward gives us the illusion of more time, it doesn't necessarily help businesses find qualified candidates any sooner. Fear not, there is a solution. ZipRecruiter. ZipRecruiter is your 24/7 hiring partner working tirelessly to connect you with the right candidate. Once you post your job on ZipRecruiter, it gets distributed to over 100 job sites, ensuring you reach a diverse pool of qualified individuals. Their smart technology scans thousands of resumes, matching you with people whose skills perfectly align with your job requirements. Spring forward with a new hiring partner, ZipRecruiter, and find top talent sooner. See why 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. Just go to this exclusive web address to try ZipRecruiter for free, ZipRecruiter.com/start here. Again, that's ZipRecruiter.com/start here. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire.
This episode is brought to you by ShipStation. If you run an e-commerce business, you know how much work it takes to produce something great while dealing with complicated shipping issues. That's why over 130,000 companies have turned to ShipStation, an innovative tool that allows you to focus less on shipping and more on building your brand. With ShipStation, you can manage orders, label printing, reporting, and customer service on one easy-to-use dashboard. You'll reduce warehouse costs with reliable enterprise solutions and save thousands on shipping costs with discounts up to 89% off. Plus, you can effortlessly import orders from everywhere you sell online. So, turn your shipping challenges into opportunities for growth. Go to ShipStation.com and use code POD to sign up for your free 60-day trial. That's ShipStation.com, code POD.
If it felt sleepy in your home following Thanksgiving, that's also the way it's kind of felt in Congress for the last week. And they don't have tryptophan to blame. And now lawmakers are back for a decisive week that could potentially result in a government shutdown. Let's get you teed up with ABC's White House correspondent Mary Alice Parks. Mary Alice, are we seriously already back here? It's shutdown time?
It could be. You have to remember earlier this fall, Congress just passed a short-term stopgap measure to keep the lights on. They kicked the can down the road like they're so good at doing. And so we are up against these deadlines again. Congress is really going to have to come back from the holiday, like you said, and hit the ground running because the government runs out of funding on Friday. We do know that this go around, both sides are talking.
You know, if the Republicans want to scrooge out on us and increase people's interest rates and make it hard to make car payments, go ahead, make that case. We're going to stop them from doing that.
There seems to be a real effort to try to come to some appropriations deals. I'm not convinced that it's going to happen by Friday.
What I anticipate is that we won't shut the government down. It will somehow, as we always do in these situations, or almost always do in these situations, is work out an agreement.
We might see them kick the can again until the new year, but we've seen all signs sort of pointing in the right direction, only to have talks fall apart.
Day 6 of the government shutdown, and with no end in sight, 800,000 federal workers are now in limbo.
We've seen that before. We've seen things come to the brink before. So I will say, while there's talks, there's still not a lot of trust. And so, yeah, the clock is ticking all over again.
What are the holdups on this, Mary Alice? Like, funding the government, such a basic thing that Congress does. So what are the reasons that they'd be like, no, not happening? Like, if you've got to go on a vacation, don't go to an National Park for the next few weeks?
Well, we had a switch of power last year. We had the government funded at Trump-era levels, which tended to be more defense spending, less non-defense spending. And Democrats have wanted to switch that. They've wanted to start limiting some defense spending and ramping up some non-defense spending. And, you know, they're getting pushback from Republicans. Not on everything, actually, but these are big, hefty, wonky, tough bills that include funding for everything from the Pentagon to Health and Human Services to housing and education. And I think that we're seeing, you know, kind of a values tug of war right now. It doesn't help Democrats that Republicans are really trying to position themselves in this moment as a party that's trying to limit spending. They really think they have a political message in this, that more government spending might be hurting inflation. And so I think that some Republicans that might have been willing to play ball are maybe being a little bit more hesitant these days.
Hey, and last time, you know, when we saw this a couple of months ago, it seemed like there was some wiggle room because they'd also just averted this big default in the national debt, right? What economists were calling this fiscal cliff. Nobody really seemed to want to be that member of Congress that then caused a government shutdown after that. Do those things still play off each other? Because we haven't solved the other problem either.
No, they also kicked that can down the road. It was just a very short-term bill to increase the debt ceiling, right, sort of allow the government to borrow enough to pay its bills just basically until the beginning of December. We did, interestingly, hear from the Treasury Secretary.
Well, our portfolio has grown to match the urgency of this moment. Our annual budget has not grown in tandem.
She said that she actually thinks the country can pay its bills, that there will be enough money until about mid-December now. There was originally concern that these two deadlines were going to be like on the same day again, just way more drama and tension and high stakes than Congress needed. And so it seems like at least there's a few more weeks to deal with the debt ceiling question. But we saw last time, we saw exactly like you said, no member of Congress really wanted to be that one that would allow the country to default. In a lot of ways, Republicans kind of blinked and they did join Democrats. But we heard a lot of frustration afterwards from Republican senators who threatened to not help Democrats again. Democrats are trying to pass this large social spending bill through the Senate, and there's a lot of Republicans that are saying, we don't support that plan, and so if you want to do that, you just take care of the debt ceiling too. We don't want to be a part of any of it.
If they want to do all of this on a partisan basis, they have the ability and the responsibility to ensure that the federal government not default.
And that's what has Democrats in a tough spot, because they might not be able to get all of their own party members together by December 15th to do both.
Right. We've seen how damaging government shutdowns can be, not just to people in the government, but to regular Americans, especially this year. You got families that are expecting that child tax credit. Usually you still get your Medicare checks. You still get your Social Security checks. People are hoping they still get these credits delivered to them. But if you couple all those concerns with a potential recession that the whole debt ceiling thing could create, a lot of uncertainty out there in the country right now. Mayor Alice Parks, deadline time as always for you. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Brad.
Jeffrey Epstein never faced trial for the most serious charges on his rap sheet.
The alleged behavior shocks the conscience.
The allegations against him that he sexually assaulted women and girls and even trafficked them to be exploited by others, those charges were never proven in a court of law.
Tonight, some of his accusers, like Michelle Licata, are outraged.
I really wanted justice.
Epstein died by suicide before his most recent trial could begin. But his former girlfriend and longtime associate, Ghislaine Maxwell, she is alive.
This case against Ghislaine Maxwell is the prequel to the earlier case that we brought against Jeffrey Epstein.
And starting today, she faces charges of her own, meaning for some families, this process starting today is the only chance for a jury to affirm what they've been saying for years. ABC senior investigative reporter Aaron Katursky will be our reporter at the federal courthouse as this plays out in New York. Aaron, what are we expecting today?
First things first, Brad, got to pick the jury. Each side's going to get some strikes, and they've narrowed it down from a pool that started at about 600 people. They'll get their 12 jurors and then six alternates, and then it's down to business. And the government, right from its opening statement, is going to say that Ghislaine Maxwell enabled Jeffrey Epstein's alleged abuse of minors as young as 14 years old.
Maxwell played a critical role in helping Epstein to identify, befriend, and groom minor victims for abuse. In some cases, Maxwell participated in the abuse herself.
They're going to say that she played a key role in a sex trafficking conspiracy in which she would traffic minors for Epstein's sordid pleasure, as has been alleged previously against him.
According to the indictment, from 2002 to 2005, Epstein recruited girls to engage in sex acts with him, after which he would give the victims hundreds of dollars in cash.
And all of this is going to unfold at a courthouse not far from where Jeffrey Epstein lived. He was on the Upper East Side of Manhattan, but this alleged sex trafficking scheme spans several states, including Florida and New Mexico, the Epstein compound in the U.S. Virgin Islands and abroad. And so all of that is going to be the focus of prosecutors over what could be a six-week trial.
Well, and we should note, the stories of Epstein and Maxwell, they're not necessarily interchangeable, right? What you've heard about Epstein, not necessarily what's being alleged against Maxwell. So what are the specific charges against her?
Yeah, Brad, Jeffrey Epstein, as alleged, is the monster. Ghislaine Maxwell, as prosecutors have portrayed it, existed to sort of help him become that monster.
Maxwell would encourage these young girls to accept offers from Epstein to pay for their travel and their education, making these young victims feel indebted to Jeffrey Epstein.
And the way they've set it up, prosecutors have said that Ghislaine Maxwell groomed the minors for Jeffrey Epstein. And what does that mean? Well, she would meet them, and then she would befriend them, take them to the movies, take them shopping, and get them comfortable talking about sex.
Maxwell would discuss sexual topics with the victim and undress in front of the victim or be present for sex acts involving the minor victims and Epstein.
And in this way, prosecutors have said that Maxwell normalized this kind of sexual relationship with Epstein and abused women as young as 14 years old.
Well, and it's specific accusers in this case, right? We've heard from a number of accusers. One of them has said that, you know, she was essentially trafficked to very high-profile men. But these are specific accusers here. What do we know about them and what role they'll play in this trial?
Yeah, all of the bold-faced names that you've heard associated with Jeffrey Epstein and that have, in many cases, been photographed with Ghislaine Maxwell are unlikely to come up except tangentially, because these accusations really focus on her alleged sex trafficking of minors, of teen girls who were underage at the time.
Maria Farmer worked for Epstein during that time and claims in a lawsuit that she saw Maxwell bring girls back to his townhouse.
Ghislaine Maxwell would go out on these drives to procure models. She would say, these are the nubiles. I need the nubiles.
And that's why the indictment has been so narrowly focused. Prosecutors don't want to get into all of the rest of it with Jeffrey Epstein. He's dead. He died by suicide in jail. And that's actually a crux of the defense case. They say that had Epstein not died, Maxwell would not have been charged. And they feel like this is just a trial by proxy. And the prosecutors are trying to hold Ghislaine Maxwell responsible for Jeffrey Epstein's crimes.
Yeah, they said Ghislaine Maxwell is not Jeffrey Epstein. He's not Ghislaine Maxwell. But we'll see how this trial against her in the cases of four women, three of them minors at the time, shapes up. Aaron Katursky will be there at the courthouse. Thanks a lot, Aaron.
Thank you, Brad.
Okay, we're going to take one more quick break. When we return, you thought last year was a weird one for maple syrup? Could be worse this year if Canada weren't so sweet. One last thing is next.
We've got the exclusive view behind the table. Every day, right after the show, while the topics are still hot, the ladies go deeper into the moments that make the view, the view. The Views Behind the Table podcast. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
And one last thing. Remember last week when there was this huge move from the U.S. where we increased our national oil supply by 50 million barrels? Well, yesterday, Canada tapped its own strategic reserves for maple syrup.
It's an insult in Canada to serve fake maple syrup on the table. It's like if you're in France and instead of serving wine, you're serving water.
Canada is the world's largest exporter of maple syrup, specifically Quebec. It's so important to the regional economy there that the Canadian government helps run this huge syrup stockpile.
The World Strategic Reserve, the jewel of the maple syrup producers of Quebec.
You know, in case there's a bad harvest one year, you don't want huge fluctuations in price. You don't want farmers going out of business. Some have called this group the Canadian cartel. It's like the OPEC of maple syrup. Well, just like oil, recently the U.S. had a shortage of syrup. Not just for pancakes. Maple syrup is increasingly used in everything from food to skin cream. Now, unlike OPEC did with oil, Canada was willing to increase its supply to keep prices down. Syrup experts, yes, they exist, say big syrup has not always been so clean.
$18 million worth of maple syrup was stolen from a storage warehouse.
Just a few years back, an infamous syrup heist resulted in sticky-fingered thieves making off with 500,000 gallons from this reserve. And while the U.S. is making use of 50 million barrels of oil, your local diner will be thankful that our neighbors have lent us a funnel that carries 50 million pounds worth of liquid gold. Always love a sappy ending. Hey, if you didn't get a chance to listen to our Friday show, check it out. A really cool look at the anatomy of spam calls. That'll give you something to talk about with the next telemarketer who calls you later today. I'm Brad Milkey. See you tomorrow.
Hey, I'm Andy Mitchell, a New York Times bestselling author.
And I'm Sabrina Kohlberg, a morning television producer.
We're moms of toddlers and best friends of 20 years.
And we both love to talk about being parents, yes, but also pop culture.
So we're combining our two interests by talking to celebrities, writers, and fellow scholars of TV and movies.
Cinema, really.
About what we all can learn from the fictional moms we love to watch.
From ABC Audio and Good Morning America, Pop Culture Moms is out now wherever you listen to podcasts.